You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We often hear about the gridlock that afflicts Washington, but less about the hidden forces and people who create and sometimes benefit from the increasingly bitter partisanship. John Harwood and Gerald Seib look at the lives of those people in their new book, Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power. Mr. Harwood is a political writer for the New York Times and the chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. Mr. Seib, is it Seib?
Yes.
Is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, columnist, and the executive Washington editor for the Wall Street Journal. Their book is published by Random House, and I'm pleased to welcome John Harwood to the show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
When you talk about backroom power in Washington, are you talking about literal backrooms or metaphorical backrooms?
I think it's metaphorical backrooms. What we set out, Leonard, to do in this book was try to explain to ourselves and then to readers how it is that Washington got into the state that it's in, where it's so unproductive, it is so nasty, it's so partisan. How does that compare to where it's been in the recent past? And what are the forces that might actually break that circumstance? And even though we didn't plan it this way when we were writing the book, I think one of the things that we discovered was the way this campaign is playing out with these two nominees, Barack Obama and John McCain. That's part of the precondition for what might actually change it, because they're not conventional politicians.
Well, you call backroom power players a new kind of power in Washington, but haven't important decisions and deals always been made in Washington backrooms? And some people are nostalgic for the good old days when the political parties nominated their presidential candidates in smoke-filled back rooms.
There's no question about it. There have always been back rooms. And there are things to like and things to dislike about that. One of the interesting things about the Democratic primary this year was that when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama seemed stuck in this endless fight, you had a rising chorus of people saying, hey, can we take this out of the hands of the voters? Can we get some Democratic power brokers in the back room to settle this thing? Because they wanted to stop it. So there is a nostalgia. And I think the nostalgia, Leonard, flows from the lack of results and productivity from Washington. Look at the big issues that we talk about over and over and over again with no result. Bill Clinton, elected in 1992 to provide universal access to health care. Democratic-controlled Congress elected with him. He could not even get a vote from a committee in the Congress. Same thing with President Bush in 2004. We've talked for years about Social Security. It's going broke. What can we do about it? The president had a provocative approach from the right to privatize partially the system, was elected, Republicans elected to Congress. He couldn't get a vote. It just shows you how easy it is for one side to checkmate the other and how consistently and evenly divided the town is, such that nothing really can get done. And Obama and McCain are hoping to smash through that.
And that's because it's not just the people in Congress who are really making these decisions. It's these people outside. What is new about the power brokers, the power players that you write about?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the nature of the disputes are more along partisan and ideological lines than they were in the past. When I was growing up, I was born in the mid-1950s. When I was growing up in the 1960s, you still had political parties that were much more scrambled ideologically. You had conservative Democrats as well as liberals. You had liberal Republicans as well as conservatives. Now, the same lines of financial interest, regional difference that have always divided our politics are reinforced by the party label. That makes it more difficult to break through. Secondly, the amounts of money involved are much more massive. And you have you've seen businesses not just in the United States but around the world seeing big stakes in the trade debates, in the economic debates in Washington. They're all trying to make themselves heard and fueling the tremendous growth in campaign spending for the politicians. And finally, what we have is the absence of some of the human connections that lubricated the political machinery in the past, that made it more possible to get solutions and results from the Congress and from the president.
But didn't that geniality between Republicans and Democrats take place at a time when the Democratic Party held long-term majorities in Congress? If the Republicans wanted to get any of their legislation passed, they had to develop allies in the opposition party. that changed somewhere down the line. I don't know whether it was during the Reagan administration or whether it was as a result of Newt Gingrich's Contract for America, or whether it was something that Karl Rove instituted, or a combination of all of the above. But the guys who ran committees in the old days were in Congress, it seemed like, for 50 or 60 years.
Exactly so. In fact, when you talk to Republicans now, some of the reporting of our book took place in 2005, 2006, when Republicans still controlled the Congress. And some of the Democrats were saying, we never treated the Republicans as badly as they're treating us right now. I talked to a former Republican committee chairman who said, yeah, they treated us fine, all right, when they were in control, just like the masters on the plantation. What really happened here was you had two things going on at the same time. Democrats had longstanding control, but you also had conservative control, because a lot of those Democrats who had been there for 50 years were Southern conservatives who got reelected over and over again. And that's part of the scrambling that I was talking about.
And they also were often allied with Republicans.
No question about it. Lyndon Johnson passed civil rights legislation in the mid-1960s with critical help from the Republican leader in the Senate, Everett Dirksen. That is the kind of thing that we simply don't see very often anymore.
Do you think that having divided power in Washington, where Congress and the White House cycle in and out of Democratic and Republican control by narrow majorities, is necessarily a bad thing?
Not necessarily. I think the critical test is, do you get results, and then do you get accountability? One of the things that potentially was an advantage for Republicans in controlling both the Congress and the White House for most of the first decade of the 21st century was that everybody knew who was in charge, and whatever the results were produced by Washington, they were going to get the benefit or the detriment from that. They won re-election in 2004 narrowly. They are now reaping the whirlwind from that. One of the challenges, though, is if you have unified control, if Democrats win the 2008 election presidentially and hold the Congress, will they have enough strength to put through their program and voters can understand what it is, or will they have to reach across the aisle, in which case it'll be accountability will be a little bit more diffused?
So you write, today in Washington, nobody's in charge, not even George Bush or Dick Cheney?
Not even George Bush and Dick Cheney. You know, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the president's news conference earlier this week. He was talking about energy policy and the forces buffeting the U.S. economy right now, which are pretty serious. And the president launched into this litany of energy proposals that he said, I've been calling for these for 7 years. I haven't gotten them through. That just underscored his inability to get cooperation from the Congress, his inability to compromise himself and to make deals. And it shows that, in fact, he's not in charge. And we may see some resistance even to this bailout that we're talking about over the last 24 hours for the two big mortgage giants, because some Republicans are defecting.
But despite President Bush's historically low approval ratings, he was recently able to get a version of the FISA bill he wanted through Congress by a large majority. Supposedly the Democrats were expected anyway to block it.
I think there was a lot of politics in that. That was a victory for President Bush, and that's a victory that traces to the advantage in recent history that Republicans have had on national security issues. And Democrats, both at the congressional level and Barack Obama running for the presidency, not wanting to hand the president a stick or John McCain a stick to beat them on in the campaign. And so they knuckled under and they made a deal.
So much of what we see in Congress today has to do with the election, the upcoming election.
There's no question about it.
John Harwood has written with Gerald F. Seib, Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power. It is published by Random House. So the backroom players that you're talking about here, they're mostly outside of government?
We've got some people outside of government. Ken Duberstein is one of the characters. He was a maverick liberal Republican, really, from Brooklyn. Came to Washington working for Jacob Javits, worked for other Republicans of the kind that don't really exist anymore, ended up in Ronald Reagan's White House, partly because of his close relationship with Nancy Reagan. He ended up as the chief of staff. Now he's outside and is one of the wise men super lobbyists in the same way that Bob Strauss, a big Democrat, was in the 1970s and 1980s. So some of them are lobbyists, they're interest group representatives, they're net roots activists. But some are members of Congress and members of the White House staff.
And they're not hurt by things they did when they were in the White House. For example, wasn't Ken Duperstein a key player in the Valerie Plame Wilson leak scandal?
Ken Duperstein was somebody who he was not a key player in the sense of actually being a conduit for information, but he was a conduit, a human conduit, between Bob Novak and Richard Armitage. One of the things about Ken Duperstein is he knows everybody around town, and so he has the way of connecting one with the other. But he was not involved in the leaking of the name.
He has been involved with Fannie Mae. I don't know whether he has played a role in the bailout that is being arranged by the White House and Congress.
Fannie Mae has got so many lobbyists, it is beyond belief in both parties. Former Clinton administration officials, Bob Zelick, who served in the both of the Bush presidencies. Now, he's now at the World Bank, but he served a stint in a top executive job at Fannie Mae. Ken Duperstein is part of that armada that have grown these things into such huge forces in the mortgage industry.
How was he affected, because he is a partisan figure, when the Democrats took back control of Congress a couple of years ago?
Well, any prominent Republican who is trading in particular on his contacts on his own side of the fence is going to be hurt when Democrats gain control. And you saw a big shift on K Street. A lot of the all-Republican firms saw a big loss of business. But Ken is diversified early on. In fact, when he went into business, he went into business with Mike Berman, who'd been a top aide to Walter Mondale, who's Jimmy Carter's vice president, unsuccessful presidential candidate against Reagan. And so the firms that have managed to work together somewhat more than those in office have worked together across the aisle have managed to find more business and be more financially healthy.
And so we see Karen Hughes, who was a major figure in the Bush White House, joining with Clinton strategist Mark Penn's PR firm, Burson Marsteller.
Exactly so. And Charlie Black, who is a top advisor to John McCain, is also an executive in a subsidiary of Burson Marsteller. This PR apparatus in Washington, the mix of corporate communications and lobbying, spreads all over town. And that's where a lot of both you have the nexus of public policy lobbying and also campaign fundraising.
The one that's the biggest mystery to me is the marriage of James Carville and Mary Madeline.
Well, that has always been a source of wonder to me as well.
Because they're so partisan.
They're so partisan, and I got to know them both separately. Mary, when she worked for the first President Bush in his campaign in 1988, and as passionate as she is about her politics and even up to the present day about the George W. Bush administration, given where her husband is, it's hard for me to see how that works, but it seems to.
My guest is John Harwood, who with Gerald F. Sieb has written Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with John Harwood of CNBC and The New York Times, who has written a book called Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, with Gerald Sieb, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, columnist, and executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. The book is published by Random House. How did this collaboration work?
Jerry Sieb and I have worked together for years at The Wall Street Journal. We first covered the Bush White House together in 1991 and 1992. When the idea for the book arose, I had a conversation with an agent, and the time frame that they wanted the book done on, I felt, while holding down a day job, was going to be difficult to do on my own. And I naturally went to Jerry. We talked about doing a book in the past, and we think alike. We write in similar styles, and so it was delightful and not difficult.
I remember when Microsoft was experiencing some problems in Washington, and everybody was shocked that they didn't have a full-time lobbyist, and suddenly they had a full-time lobby operation. Is part of this explosion of lobbyists a matter of companies and industries working in self-defense?
Absolutely. One of the things that one of the lobbyists that we spoke to for the book, Wayne Berman, whose wife was also a character in the book, she was the social secretary in the George W. Bush White House, he said that companies have come to see this as part of their risk insurance and that they hire lobbyists even if they don't have a particular problem because they know that they might have one on short notice. Look what happened in that Dubai Ports World deal, something that was all set to go through and nobody thought it was going to be controversial, and suddenly it was the biggest political economic story in the country. That's one of the reasons – and by the way, once it got to be that big, there was nothing that lobbyists could do to stop it.
Well, because the press got in on it.
Right. And what you're raising exactly, Leonard, the right point, which is that the – first of all, a lot of the lobbying in Washington is a bit of a scam, I think, because there are many things that people get paid for getting produced that would have been produced anyway. But secondly, lobbying is most effective when the light of public and press interest is not there. When it is there, when an issue is raised onto the stage, that's when the forces of public opinion expressed through polls, expressed on the internet and emails, that can rise up and match the lobbying power of money. Then it becomes a fair fight.
Do you think that it's easier to stop something from happening than to make it happen in Washington today? I'm thinking of the Dubai Ports deal or even earlier, the Clinton health plan, whatever its merits.
That is part of the structure of our system, and certainly that system is able to be exercised more consistently now than in the past. And when I talk about the structure, I'm talking about the power to filibuster in the Senate. If you've got 41 votes, you can stop anything from moving forward. And when you look at the nature of the minorities that we have had in recent years, whether Democrats or Republicans have been in control, there have been plenty of opposition to whichever side is in the leadership to muster those 41 votes and stop most things from getting through.
Another major player is Billy Towson. He was a Democrat who switched parties. I would think that he would be considered a traitor by the Democrats.
He is to some degree, but I think a lot of people recognize that the ideological changes that have occurred more broadly in the country are bigger than the choices that any particular individual made. What Billy Towson did in following the kind of narrative arc of the country and realigning itself with conservatives in the South flocking to Republicans and away from the Democratic Party, there were millions of voters who were doing precisely the same thing. A significant, not as large, of course, but a significant number of office holders. And Billy served in the Congress as a Democrat from Louisiana for a while and finally became so uncomfortable. And there was an expedient thing about it as well, because he shifted over to the Republicans as they were taking control. And all of a sudden, he could be a chairman, a committee chairman with the new Republican administration. And then he had some health problems. He decided to leave the Congress. And now he's lobbying for the pharmaceutical industry, which is needs all the help it can get given. I mean, it has wealth and power on the one hand, but if you look at the polls, it's very, very unpopular right now with the public. One of the driving forces for health reform is the antagonism toward the insurance industry in general and the pharmaceutical industry in particular.
Is from reaching out to Democrats now that they control Congress?
Yes. It's only smart for any of the interest groups, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce to particular trade groups representing different sectors. They go where the power is. Many of them divide their contributions relatively evenly, or they may have a stronger pro-Republican tilt when Republicans are in power. But certainly when Democrats are in power, they're going to make sure that they have access to those members of Congress. There's a phrase people use in Washington, pay to play, and there are a lot of interest groups that, in fact, are more than willing to play and pay.
So you just look where they're throwing money at to see who they think is going to be in power in the near future.
Yes. And one of the benefits for ordinary citizens over the from the internet is that they can find this information very quickly. There are fabulous public policy research organizations. OpenSecrets.org is a website that if you click on it, you can find out where money industry by industry is going. And those shifts are quite dramatic once you see the power shift from Republican to Democrat in the Congress.
So if lobbyists are donating equally to both parties, maybe more to one at one point and more to the other at another point, do you think things like healthcare will ever really be changed?
I think what changes the system and what could break through is the combination of public disgust, which you look at these polls now, Leonard, 80% of the American people say the country's headed in the wrong direction. President Bush's approval ratings under 30%. That creates a pretty strong breeze for change. And if you get the right kind of political leadership, then you can make it happen. Barack Obama's going to face a choice if he wins this election. Which the polls would tell us now he would be favored to do. He's going to almost certainly have a Democratic-controlled Congress with him. Does he try to run through a partisan program, or does he try to reach out the aisle, across the aisle, build bridges the way that he's talked about? That's one of the keys to how successful he will be, I believe.
But part of the problem, getting back to the Dubai port story, is it in the end, some things are just totally out of your own hands. A rival group, a lobbying group working for a rival shipping company, breaks this story. It takes off like mad. Nobody can predict that it's going to take off the way that it did. And suddenly, everybody involved finds their hands tied.
That's true. Certainly, you have to say that the media plays a part in that. Talk radio, the blogosphere, some of the shows on cable television pick up these populist issues and fan them in a way that that goes against what the judgment that our elected officials may have in Washington. Now, that's not to say either side is right or wrong, but it is to say that you're exactly right. Once one of these brush fires forms, and nobody had any indication that Dubai Ports was going to be a brush fire at all before it happened, then it becomes very, very difficult to contain.
Early in the book, you seem to stress that the ratings decline of the primetime network newscast has been a bad thing. There are people who would argue that the new media, like blogs, have democratized news gathering and in some cases have broken stories that the mainstream media have either overlooked or refused to cover. Dubai is not one of those cases because everybody jumped on that one.
That's true. But I do think there is a cost from the decline of the major broadcast networks. And that's not a lament or a call to bring them back. It's a reality. There was more when I was growing up and you were growing up, there was more of a common conversation in the country, people tuning into the same set of facts and analysis, people having a common set of premises and assumptions. Now, in the niche media that we have, on the net, on cable, on radio, you have people having their own opinions reinforced, going to friendly ideological spots on the dial. And I think that makes it more difficult to reach consensus.
During the Clinton years, many people suggested that his problems were caused to some degree by the culture wars. They were the last gasp of the culture wars of the 1960s. Do you think that cooperation in Washington will get easier once a new, younger generation of leaders takes over?
Barack Obama's going to test that out if he wins the election. Part of his explicit call is that we need to turn the page on those old fights from the 60s. So all the things that were dramatized by Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich in their fights in the 1990s, things that derive from the position on the spectrum that people took on the Vietnam, on the civil rights movement, on the sexual revolution, on sex, drugs, and rock and roll in general during the 1960s, all those things are much less relevant to Barack Obama's generation and those younger. And I think that is a possibility to take some of the toxins out of our politics and move on to a different conversation.
But you keep on talking as though Barack Obama is likely to win. We don't know. A lot can happen between
True.
Now and November. What happens if John McCain, who's 72 years old?
Well,
if he wins.
First of all, John McCain is likely to pick a younger running mate who would be part of the process of moving on. But John McCain is not an easy to pigeonhole politician either. And I think anything that
shakes
up the day.
He doesn't use a computer.
He doesn't use a computer.
I'm old. I use a computer.
I think John McCain will learn how to communicate adequately if he comes president. But what my point is that if you shake up the deck, if you have somebody who has a different style and a different base of support, as John McCain will be if he gets elected, that is part of the precondition for changing the way Washington works.
John Harwood is the chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and a political writer for the New York Times. He has co-authored with Gerald F. Seib, who's an assistant managing editor and the executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, a book called Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.